Hi, everyone. My name is Andy McAfee. I do research and teach about technology at MIT, and I have the huge pleasure this afternoon of being on stage and having the chance to talk with Tim O'Reilly, who I don't think needs much of an introduction, but he's going to get one anyway. And in particular, I want to give a specific flavor of introduction. We're going to ask, I think, a number of fairly of audience participation questions. Let me start with a pretty stupid one. How many of us are familiar with Tim and his work? Sir, do me a favor. How many of us know what he majored in college? All right, Tim was a classics major in college and followed the well-trod career path of classics major into technology, evangelist, and entrepreneur. And so keeping I thought I would do something that Tim will have to respect as a classicist but kind of dislike as a fairly modest person. I want to offer a panegyric to start off our session today. And those of us who followed Tim's path and became classics majors know that a panegyric is a speech that one gives at the opening of a session, and in particular, it's a speech in praise of a particular person, in this case, Tim, who after graduating from college in 75, followed the classic path of a classicist and became a technology entrepreneur starting in about 1978, and has been at the head of O'Reilly Media in its various incarnations since then. Where things get really interesting for me as I look back on Tim's career is in about 1992, because two different things happened that year. The first is that O'Reilly published the whole Internet User's Guide and Catalog, which included a chapter about this new doohickey called the World Wide Web. And that same year, Tim and his colleagues put up what we think is the very first e-commerce site, which was called the Global Network Navigator, or GNN, which Tim described as a, quote, wild-ass scheme, which was the first portal, the first e-commerce site, the first ad-supported site on the Internet. And the reason I bring this up is not just because those were isolated events, but instead because they kicked off this absolutely amazing 20-year run on the part of Tim and his colleagues at O'Reilly of being at the forefront of just about every important trend in the technology industry. And we'd use up all our time if I tried to list all of them, but here are a few that I put together pretty quickly. The open source movement, the makers movement, Netroots activism and coming together to address things like the fight against the SOPA and PIPA legislation, ebooks, government 2.0, web 2.0, and big data. That's kind of a greatest hits list of the things that we care a lot about and that have become a big deal in the technology industry. And a lot of us have realized that. I'm going to throw a couple quotes out here. Eric Schmidt says, Tim can really make a whole industry happen. And Evan Williams, the co-founder and former CEO of Twitter, talks about Tim's approach to the industry versus a lot of what else goes on. He says, there's a quick money originality that is often pervasive in Silicon Valley. Tim has the ability to push people like myself to think bigger and more creatively, which is just a lovely way to summarize what Tim's been doing for us. And I'm aware of more than one extraordinarily successful technologist and founder in the industry who directly credits the idea to something, an idea that Tim put in their head. So, in addition to which, he has this really weird combination of talents, in addition to being an overused term, but I think an accurate one, a visionary about what's happening in this space, and someone who thinks long and deeply about these important questions. He's also one of these weird human Rolodexes, and he has this ability to bring really interesting people from many different domains and spheres together, let them interact productively, and seems to know everyone of any importance or matter in the technology industry. The final adjective that I'll attach to him is mensch. And if you spend any time with Tim, you realize that he's just one of the good guys of the industry and of this space that we're all so excited about. An article in Inc. magazine about him a while back called him the Oracle of Silicon Valley, which I think is pretty good. I want to add one more phrase to that list. I think he's the sage of Sebastopol, which is where O'Reilly Media is headquartered. And I'll say a couple more things, and then we'll try to make Tim's face stop being so red. I wrote a while back, and I continue to believe, that if he didn't exist, the technology industry would have to invent him. And the last thing that I want to say is that whatever else might happen in my personal career, whatever accolades or awards might come my way, I know that one that I will be proudest of is to be considered a foo, a friend of O'Reilly. So, Tim, it's a real pleasure to have you with us. Thank you.
In response to that, I can only say my reputation exceeds me.
None of us are buying that, Tim. Yeah. The title for our session today is Create More Value Than You Capture, which is a mantra that you've tried to guide your activities and your company by for a while. I want to dive in on that mantra a little bit. And if I could ask you to talk about either people or organizations or maybe entire industries that you've seen who do a particularly good job or have done a particularly good job, present company accepted for now, of living that mantra, and then in contrast, ones that have done a comparatively lousy job in your opinion?
Well, first off, let me say I want to talk a little bit about why this notion has a fair amount of urgency for me. And that's in 2008, we saw an incredible example of an industry that once existed to serve society. Banking has a noble tradition. It's part of the whole notion of providing liquidity for economic transactions is really powerful. And I first started thinking about the changing role of banking a little bit before the financial crisis. I don't remember what year it was. I went to do a conference called Money Tech, and my big what I was trying to do, I thought, wow, the internet is becoming an economy. What can we learn from the financial economy? And what I learned was sort of sobering and, of course, came home to roost in 2008. And it was this guy who'd been a longtime market participant, Bill Janeway, was sort of the vice chairman of Warburg Pincus, a big investment firm, said that, financial firms used to trade on behalf of their clients, and then gradually they began to trade against their clients. And we saw where that ended in the debacle of 2008, in which companies that were reaping enormous value for themselves were actually destroying economic value for society. And that was sort of a really great reminder of this principle that we've tried to live by at O'Reilly of create more value than you capture, because banking went from a value-creating industry to a value-destroying industry by trying to keep too much of it for themselves. And this sort of fits a pattern that I've seen in technology. Take Microsoft. I mean, most of us, if you're on the younger side, you grew up in the era when Microsoft was the, quote, evil empire. They never really were the evil empire. I mean, there's always been an incredible number of good people there. But what most of you missed were the early days in which Microsoft was the scrappy visionary upstart, the company that had this boldly ambitious vision of a computer on every desk and every home, and everybody thought they were nuts, And they were, they went on to create a huge part of the world that we all live in, with their ambitious vision of ubiquitous personal computing and breaking the stranglehold of the evil empire of their day, IBM, which was sort of this, people forget, IBM had 90% of the computer market and would charge you, basically they had the difference between, there was one famous incident where the difference between two models of a computer, one which cost like maybe three times the cost of the other, could be changed by moving one jumper. electronics, it's just a little plug that goes, basically moving one jumper in the back, but it was illegal to do that, right? Got it. So it was just this sort of, so here Microsoft went from, creating this whole ecosystem in which there were thousands, tens of thousands of developers to one in which they started to consume most of the value, ended up freezing out. And of course, the value creators went somewhere else. They went to this crazy thing called the internet, where people were doing things for the love of it, not because they thought there was any money there. As Andy pointed out, at O'Reilly, we created the first commercial site on the World Wide Web. Because we said, hey, we think there's something here, that could turn into something commercial. And, of course, it did. But so there's this cycle in which new industries seem to create enormous value for society. As they mature, they start to sort of hold on and take too much of the value for themselves.
And do you think that's just kind of a historical pattern? Is that the way of the world?
I think it's partly the way of the world. But an enlightened company thinks about this, because if you really study this pattern, you realize that to maintain your success, you really should keep that virtuous cycle going. And to do that, you must create more value than you capture. The definition of ultimate ecosystem failure is when you start taking more out than you create. And so it's sort of interesting because, of course, that's a metaphor for our entire society. We have this extractive industries. You look at the whole energy market. You look at the way we're consuming more resources than we should. We're not, effectively we're stealing from our grandchildren. And we have to actually start thinking about our economy fundamentally differently. And there's a set of issues embedded in that thought that I'm trying to unpack. Because if we want, I've been working a lot with government policy and even, very narrow areas of government policy like SOPA and PIPA, we have to start thinking about where is value being created rather than where it's being captured. So to give a very concrete example of that, Tim Berners-Lee put the web into the public domain when he created it. And of course, you can see enormous value that was created there. That was realized by players like Yahoo and Google and Amazon and millions of other websites, but also by all kinds of small businesses who are able to communicate better. And this huge value creation throughout society. Versus say that Goldman Sachs example. Where these guys are manipulating food prices and people are starving as a result. Manipulating
the financial. Wait, that's bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Manipulating, the real estate market, the whole, all those crazy things, that are basically sociologically, pathological, for society. And so yet, we look at all of our measurements of the economy are about value capture when it's so clear that you can capture a lot of value for yourself while actually destroying value for society. And so we need to start thinking differently about all that.
And you bring up Sir Tim Berners-Lee as an example here, who never really tried to profit from his brainchild, from the World Wide Web and its protocols.
Let me go a little further. It's not only that he didn't try to profit. I don't think it would have worked if he did. Because, in fact, there were existing systems at the time that... did much of the same thing, maybe even did it better. I still remember in 1994, a little bit into the web, at Esther Dyson's PC Forum, Nathan Merville gave this, who was the CTO of Microsoft at the time, gave this great talk about the Microsoft Network. And he was talking all about, he had this graph, a classic. He actually was probably the first time I ever saw the long tail graph,
okay.
Although he didn't actually talk about the tail. He said, there's a few documents that are read by millions of people, millions of documents that are read by only one or two people, and there's this really interesting zone in the middle, and that's what we're trying to do with the Microsoft Network. And I remember going up and during the Q&A saying, I think you're absolutely right, Nathan, but there's this new thing called the World Wide Web that's actually going to attack that better than the Microsoft Network. Because the Microsoft Network was, literally we'd had that conversation because we were, we were this successful tech publisher, and Microsoft had approached us, and the rules were pay us $50,000, come onto the Microsoft Network, be a content provider.
Fine. Yep.
And, our alternative was, download a web server, put up your own content, and, which of those models won? It was the beginning of a certain kind of intangible economy, not the pure beginning, but an example of a kind of intangible economy that was based on sharing, non-monetization. And it really is important. The monetization often comes later. My observation after all my years in this industry is so often the value creation starts with people having fun, doing things for love, for passion, and only later do the entrepreneurs say, we actually see how to turn that enthusiasm into money.
But you're not anti-entrepreneur. You're not anti-capitalist at all. You yourself are
I'm a capitalist.
A pretty first-rate capitalist.
I wouldn't say I'm first-rate. I've had more than one billionaire say to me, hey, it all started with one of your books, and I got $35 out of it. But so I wouldn't call that a first-rate capitalist.
But what's interesting is I don't hear you talking about any contradiction between these two systems, between the system of...
No, in fact, it's sort of like if you understand it better, you can actually be more successful as an entrepreneur or an investor because you understand where to look. You know, by the time there are all these people swarming around, you know, trying to make money at it, you're way too late. You know, I mean, you know, nobody thought the World Wide Web was a place to make money. In fact, nobody really thought it was a place to make money, you know, for quite a long time after, you know, it came out. And right now we're seeing the same thing with the maker movement. When we launched Make Magazine in 2005, you know, it's like, oh, here's this crazy guy who made a programmable cat feeder out of an old VCR was one of the articles in the first issue. You know, and now there are quite a few, you know, multi-million dollar businesses in the maker space. You know, a lot of the trends that were predicted by these people playing with sensors and new kinds of actuators and, you know, DIY technology, you know, they've turned into real businesses. And there's many more to come. And now the venture capitalists, 7 years into Maker Faire, are showing up in droves.
Okay. You know? So you're describing a pretty healthy dynamic of this interaction between the people who do stuff for passion and play and the financiers and the entrepreneurs who show up and kind of turn those into markets. Talk to us about what you think is unhealthy these days or where your concerns are. Because, you know, a good capitalist would look at that and go, hey, this is all fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, one thing that's unhealthy is when you see a huge number of startups that are focused on, you know, raising money and then having an exit. You know, I use the analogy of you know, money as gas in your car. You know when you're running a business, you have to keep gas in the tank. You don't want to end up by the side of the road. But you don't think that when you go on a road trip, it's a tour of gas stations. And there's an awful lot of businesses that act and think like they're on a tour of gas stations.
And we just want to get to the next bigger gas station.
That's right.
Bigger tank.
And I find that kind of entrepreneurship kind of despicable, quite frankly.
Okay.
And I'd love to see people, you know, so I'm much more attracted. Obviously, there's the sweet spot where you see somebody who really wants to create value, wants to change the world in a positive way, and has identified an area where people are willing to pay you. But for me, the venture model has gotten fairly distorted. You know, I love the fact that at O'Reilly, we never took a dime of venture capital, that we, you know, I started the company with $500. I found customers who valued what I did enough that they would pay me for it.
Okay.
And I feel like we need to, you know, we need to find more businesses like that. We need to believe in businesses like that. And of course, we're actually starting to see a resurgence of that. On the good side, there are new channels. I mean, look at something like Kickstarter, which is not just launching, you know, people see it as patronage, but it's also becoming a new form of funding for product development. You know, there's a really interesting intangible economy of, you know, I'm going to kind of tell you my passion, and I'm going to find people who believe in it, and they're going to commit to pay me if I come through.
Yep.
That's sort of a wonderful beginning at a new way of thinking about those problems. But I guess so that's one thing I think is wrong. But probably the biggest thing, I think that we don't have enough people who are trying to make a difference. You know, the problem is, you know, and I think we also have this.
So when you look around the tech industry at present, do you see too high a proportion of the people chasing the funding, chasing the good exit, chasing...
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And, you know, I do think that, you know, if you look at the great companies, they almost always had some kind of higher purpose. You know, Jim Collins and... I forget who's co-author on Built to Last and Good to Great and all those companies, all those books... You know, said great companies have big, hairy, audacious goals.
Yep.
And, you know, when you look at Microsoft's PC on every desk and in every home, that was a big, hairy, audacious goal, although now it sort of seems like commonplace. You know, Google, access to all the world's information, big, hairy, audacious goal. You know, Facebook, how can we make the world more social? I think, Mark, when you talk, I mean, you know, when you talk with him, you understand he's chipping away at the future in a way. You know, and yes, he's you know, just like Bill Gates and Larry and Sergey, you know, he's a great entrepreneur, but he's working on a real problem, and that's what I see motivating his thinking. You look at Twitter, it didn't have that sort of same relentless focus on I'm going to find this conjunction of a problem and business model, but here's this wonderful value creating.
We're going to let people express themselves with very little friction all over the world with whatever device.
Yeah, and I guess I want to kind of back up a little bit to the open source movement, which has had such an impact, on the world that we all live in, and whose creators have often not profited at anything like the level of most internet entrepreneurs whose work really has depended on what they did. I mean, think about it. The TCP/IP stack came out of UC Berkeley, and became this, as part of Berkeley Unix originally. You think about, the whole web infrastructure, Apache. You think about, email, all these things. The guys who created that didn't make buckets of money, but they built the world that we take for granted.
And those guys are incredibly interesting for at least two reasons. One is that they are, a lot of what they do are examples of what you talk about as the clothesline paradox. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, this was something that came up. It makes me feel a little old to say this, but it's a paper that I read in 1975 in Coevolution Quarterly, which was Stuart Brand's magazine that was a follow-on to the Whole Earth Catalog. And it made a real impression on me. It's by a guy named Steve Bayer. You can Google for it. It's actually now up on the web, probably because I started talking about it a few years ago. And at the time, I found an old PDF of it. Now it's actually up on the web. This guy was writing about alternative energy. And again, it's sort of sad that in 1975, we were talking about the same issues that we are facing so urgently today. And, we just missed our opportunity. You guys may remember after the Arab oil shock in 73.
How many of us remember after the Arab oil shock in 73?
Yeah, sorry.
Smattering of hands at best. Take us back there.
Jimmy Carter at solar.
How many of us remember Jimmy Carter?
Yeah.
Take us back there.
Sorry. Jimmy Carter had solar panels on the roof of the White House. He said to Americans, we actually need to change our energy habits. Don't turn on the heater, put on a sweater. He got ridiculed for it. And when Ronald Reagan came into the White House, he had those solar panels taken down, reversed our whole, all the efforts to become energy independent. You can kind of look at the chain of bad decisions that led us into wars in Iraq because we have to protect our oil supply. All these kinds of issues where just we made a bad set of decisions.
Yep.
We knew, anyway, all the way back in the 70s, this was going to be a problem, and we just kicked the can down the road. We've kicked the can down the road on the financial crisis. We're robbing our grandchildren because we keep thinking, man, we just need to get for ourselves instead of creating value for society. But anyway, back to this clothesline paradox. Steve Bayer had this really great insight. He said when somebody decides to hang their clothes on a clothesline instead of putting them in the dryer, we don't take that little energy savings and move it from the fossil fuel column into the renewables column in our accounting. It just disappears.
So it's literal as shrinkage in the economy. The economy looks smaller than it used to.
That's right. And so you can look at a lot of issues, like in the soap. This is a great metaphor for a lot of how we think about the internet economy.
Yep.
When people entertain themselves by watching free YouTube videos or interact with friends on Facebook instead of watching, Hollywood movies or buying, copyrighted content, the copyright industry says, oh, look at the value that was destroyed. The free internet is destroying value. But it's quite clear, no, we're actually, it's just, that's like the utility saying, oh my God, those people hanging their clothes on clotheslines, they're destroying value. They're not using our product.
Yep. And by that definition, the open source software movement has shrunk the software industry.
Absolutely.
And therefore destroyed value.
That's right.
Except that was
exactly what Bob Young, who started Red Hat, said. He said, my goal is to shrink the size of the operating system market. And, you know, you look at MySQL, shrunk the size of the database market. But it didn't really.
Yeah.
Because, of course, it actually grew it. What we understand now is that when you have these kinds of breakthroughs in generosity, you actually grow the market. You grow value for society.
But you don't grow the economy that we know how to measure and that we're kind of pointing our measurement instruments at.
That's right. Although often you grow it, we just don't look at the measurement. So here's a great example. Somebody pays $60 a month to their cable company to watch television. Our content industry say, oh, that's a very nice transaction. Thank you very much. Somebody pays $60 a month to their ISP to look at, quote, free content on the internet.
Yep.
You know, it's real. The value is realized by a different group of people, although actually they're now kind of, you know, talking out of both sides of their mouth because they're often the same people.
Yeah, right.
but when we get the money for that, it's free. When we get the money for that, it's not. It's
yep.
sort of just crazy. You know, so I think we have to reset our economic thinking in some cases to notice where the economic transactions are happening.
But that's, speaking as someone who's looked at this a little bit, that's actually fiendishly hard to do because it's comparatively straightforward to measure dollars spent, you know, dollars in, dollars out. What do we need to measure instead? How do we measure value?
I don't know the answer to that.
Damn.
I know that your colleague, Eric Brynjolfsson.
So, Tim met my colleague and co-author, Eric Brynjolfsson, who just did this lovely piece of work. There's a set of scholars who are trying to dive into this question, classically trained in economics, trying to estimate the size of this economy that Tim's just been talking about. And their most rigorous and conservative estimates, and I think they're far too conservative, say that the size of the free economy, the stuff that we can't measure, but that we're showing our preference for by consuming, that's on the order of a couple percent of our GDP per year growing instead of shrinking. So it ain't trivial at all. And as I say, as I look at their work, it seems that they're trying as hard as they can to lowball the estimate.
Opposed to the content industry, which just tries as hard as they can to highball and
attribute it all to piracy.
That's right. The movie industry included in their losses to piracy the losses to farmers who grew the corn for the popcorn that sold in the movie theaters. You know.
So congrats. You're all part of the death of the family farm. I hope you feel better. Go ahead.
Yeah, maybe this is going a little further than this. I'd love to kind of talk a little bit about the changing shape of the economy, and in particular the reason why I actually picked Andy to come do this interview with me is because of this little book that he wrote called Race Against the Machine with Eric, actually about some, which is a fact.
One person has read that book and thought enough to clap for it. Thank you very much.
I really suggest you guys all read it. It's you can download it as an ebook or
it's physical now too.
Yeah, it started as an ebook, but it's now a physical book. But really fascinating piece of work about why the jobs. Why many jobs may not come back in our economy, and why we really have to start thinking about a new shape to the economy. So maybe talk about the argument of the book for a minute.
And this is actually a great segue because this is the next set of questions I wanted to pose to Tim. So we have one set of challenges which are pretty clear and substantial about measuring value in our economy. We have another set of challenges around compensating people for contributing value in this economy because, as Tim says, a lot of the people who are putting value out there are doing it in ways that don't immediately lead to recompense or compensation. There's another problem which Eric and I dove in on the book, which is that as technology just races ahead and continues to demonstrate just weirdly powerful new capabilities and skills, the data are becoming pretty clear that it's leaving some people and a larger number of people behind in our economy over time. And the super shorthand way to talk about that is think about what happens when we hook up Siri to Watson and let both of those technologies improve for a few years. Because if they follow the trajectory of Moore's Law, and they're going to follow it with at least that much acceleration, they're going to be about 16 times better than they currently are in 6 years. Now, I think that puts a lot of what people are currently doing for a living right in the sights of the automation of the economy. And I don't think it's a stretch at all to think that we're going to find it quaint in just a few years when we dial the phone to a company and a human being is on the other end of that line. It strikes me that's going to become passé.
Well, we've already kind of moved that way, just badly with IVRs,
right? Yeah. But to the same in the same way that we find shopping at a really good e-commerce site a pleasurable experience that gives us good recommendations, and we prefer it in a lot of ways. I think we might get to the point where the automated economy is preferable to us as consumers.
And by the way, a lot of that, this sort of back on the sort of the value proposition. A huge part of that is actually customer self-service. Yep. You know, so we, and it's part of what's in crowdsourcing as well. You know, we do work that was formerly done by paid people.
Yep.
Because the automation enables us to do it differently. But the net-net, of course, is actually an acceleration of a trend that we've seen and that came to light in the financial crisis.
Right.
And that is the fact that we are losing kind of this big middle class that we took for granted because we're taking away more and more jobs.
That they have historically done.
And there was a fascinating talk at TED by a guy who's very, very successful. I'm forgetting his name right now. I'm having a bit of a blank on it. But he was the founder of Aquantive, which was acquired by Microsoft for something like $6 billion and was a founding investor at Amazon. So very successful entrepreneur. And he got up there at TED University a couple of weeks ago, and he kind of made a passionate plea. He said, "I am so sick and tired of hearing about how investors create jobs." He said, "Investors never created a single job in their life. Customers create jobs. You know, the only reason why you need investors is because you have people who are, you know, you can't keep up with demand, you know, for your product, right? And if we don't have people who can pay for that, you know, for our products, we have no jobs." And so if you start looking at a couple of trends, first of all, the fact that we've, you know, the income inequality, which has been the focus of Occupy Wall Street, and you look at this sort of question of creating value versus capturing value, if you have too small a group that's capturing too much of the value and not giving it back, you fundamentally, the whole ecosystem breaks down ultimately. And
all the trends are that we're heading in that direction as opposed to a more egalitarian economy in society.
And so that kind of led, and then so when I read your book, what was so fascinating to me is okay, so it's a situation that's been, first of all, framed by the race of our economy to take labor costs out, you know, and what we've failed to do is to find a way to redistribute those gains. We've had them go disproportionately to a very small number of people. You know, and I find it fairly inconscionable that, you know, companies, you know, basically firing workers while paying, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses to a few top executives because, quote, we can't afford, you know, that's just bullshit. You know, the fact is, no, we've made choices about who we're going to reward and, you know, and they're ultimately self-destructive choices for our society.
Okay.
And so, but now here's this other thing, you know, just with the race of technology, more and more jobs being taken over by machines. Oh, well, this isn't helpful. sorry. You know, and, you know,
You had a fascinating conversation a while back because I was laying out the thesis of the book, and I found it really easy to find examples of encroaching automation and jobs under threat. Tim did the best job of pointing me toward examples of job creation, not just among the data scientists and web designers of the world, which I was anticipating, but you gave me a couple of great examples of people putting labor back
into
the economy.
Well, let me put it this way. I'm looking for those examples, and I'm starting to find them. I, you know, the way my mind works is I sort of have some notion, and then I start looking for data to support that notion or to disprove it. And in this case, the notion I came to was, oh, given what I said about the fact if you don't have any consumers, you don't have any, you know, businesses, we're going to have to put labor back into the economy. We're going to have to find a way to pay people, or people will have to find a way to pay each other, or whatever. We'll have a very new shape to the economy. And that's really the heart of what I'm trying to talk about here.
Good.
And so I'm starting to look for signs of this.
What are the green shoots that you see?
Well, so here are a couple of green shoots. I want to mention first kind of the use of computing to add value to what were formerly low-skill jobs that you know, we've been trying to wring out of the economy. And I, you know, my first case is the Apple Store. You know, think about most retailers. They're stripping out sales clerks. They're stripping out, you know, people to help you.
And let me just second that. Retail has historically been a huge employer in the economy, and it has seen the most, probably the most job destruction of any industry over the past 5 to 10 years. So here's an interesting counter trend.
So then Apple basically figures out that you can enable like this huge success by, first of all, you know, creating all these people to help other people. And they're giving them incredible equipment. You know, if you go into the Apple Store and they just, you know, somebody comes up to you and say, I want that product, and they, you know, check you out on the iPhone and email you your receipt, and you walk out of the store with a sticker on it. And
you kind of feel like you're shoplifting the first time you do that,
yeah,
right? Like, where was the cashier and the cash register
part? It's like they're reinventing it. But anyway, so I just, okay, here's, that's one point. So I was talking with Todd Park, who's our new federal CTO, by the way, and if you didn't see him the other day, you should look at the video. Todd is an inspiration. But anyway, he says, oh, actually, you know, you just gave me another example. Walgreens is trying to do the same thing for healthcare. And by the way, you know, where they're going to have a sort of the equivalent of a genius bar for, you know, people with prescriptions. And yep. I don't know how well they'll execute on, but it's another trend point. And he said, and by the way, you know, we have this new thing called the Accountable Care Act, you know, the so-called Obamacare. And, you know, one of the key features of that is they're trying to move our healthcare system for pay for quantity of care to pay for outcomes, you know, so that you know, like if people don't have to go to the hospital, the savings get to be kept by the doctor in the hospital, some of the savings, right? Because it turns out that something like 5% of Medicare patients, for example, generate 40% of the claims.
Yep.
And often it's like, it's because they're going in for all these different complaints with uncoordinated care, and, you know, or people who don't take their medications and then they end up back in the emergency room. And so this whole movement, what they realize, oh, what we could do is effectively, just like Apple created this new class of sales, of sort of augmented, you know, computer augmented sales
clerks.
We can actually have home healthcare people, you know, who actually have IT backing them up to say, oh, check in with Mrs. Jones, see if she took her meds.
Yep.
It's a new kind of home healthcare. So it's, again, here's an interesting, you know, piece on that same trend line. Now, okay, so let's leave that one aside. I think about Kickstarter. You know, I think about Etsy. These are examples of putting labor costs back into the economy. I have this great example at home. I have this beautiful, beautiful light fixture in my dining room. And it's actually sort of a, you know, it's a $10 or whatever. I don't know what the original price is. IKEA lamp, you know, probably made in China.
Yep.
On which somebody has lovingly pasted circles cut out of musical scores. And it creates a beautiful illuminated effect. So
paid a bit more than $10 for that.
I paid about $300 for it, right? Because somebody basically took a commodity product and lovingly added value to it and then resold it. And I thought, oh, that's kind of an interesting data point. And I think we'll be doing more of that kind of added value for each other in this future economy. And, you know, Kickstarter, people looking, you know, saying, hey, I want to make this product. Do you want it?
Good.
You know, people kind of trying to come up with a new medium of exchange. You know, and you look at things like, you know, this whole YouTube economy, you know, where artists are starting to make real living, you know, in this case supported by advertising. But we're starting to see the shape of some interesting new economic transitions there. We're also seeing other aspects of the peer-to-peer sharing economy with, you know, things like Airbnb and
how many of us are staying in an Airbnb found place for South by? Hands, look at this. Hands way up. Look around the room. Okay, that's pretty astonishing.
And, you know, relay rides, city car share, you know, so there's a whole P2P thing that's happening. And, you know, what's sort of interesting to me, going back on this notion of economic cycles, is it seems to me, you know, when you see a sharing economy, it eventually does get monetized. You know, like the early web was just everybody was equal. We were all just doing things for each other.
Stuff, yep.
And then this advertising economy grew up around it.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, and there's still a huge distance ahead for that advertising economy. You know, the internet average share of advertising is still a fraction of television.
Great.
Even though there's more hours now spent on the internet entertaining each other than there are spent on television. So there's a lot of money to come from one industry into another. And that kind of leads me to a policy recommendation, which is that you know, policymakers need to focus on protecting the future from the past rather than protecting the past from the future. And, you know, most of the policy that we see is oriented towards protecting incumbents because, of course, they have the loudest voices
and the biggest checkbooks.
Yeah, and I had this really interesting, you know, conversation with Nancy Pelosi about SOPA and PIPA, and it was sort of eye-opening because, you know, I was just explaining my experience as a publisher. You know, we've been publishing books DRM-free, and yes, some people steal them, you know, particularly in countries where they weren't going to pay us anyway. And meanwhile, a lot of people...
And that doesn't keep you up at night,
it does not seem. Keep me at night because, in fact, our business is growing. We're selling in markets that we could never have sold before. You know, it's this rapidly growing part of my business. I'm kind of explaining it, and she says, yeah, but we have to take into account the concerns of Hollywood. And I was like, no, you don't. You have to find the right answer for society. Your job is to work for all of us. It's not to work for this interest group versus that interest group. And
all right, Tim, I'm going to stop you because we want to leave plenty of time for interaction from the audience. We're going to open it up in just a second for questions from the audience. The only thing I'd like to remind us all of is that brevity is the soul of a great question.
Also a great intro, I should say.
No. Not all the time. Touche. The last thing I want to ask you to do before we throw it open is to throw out advice to a young innovator. And you know that's a takeoff. You've quoted the poet Rilke in a few of your talks. He wrote a lovely series of letters to a young poet giving advice to the next generation. What's your advice to young innovators, young entrepreneurs?
Well, I guess the first thing is, you know, is work on stuff that matters. Work on stuff that you will look back on and be proud of. Work on stuff that, actually, there was a great line once in a science fiction book called The Last Dancer by Daniel Keyes Moran that I love. And it was something like, he says, you know, people ask you what you would die for. And fact is, what you're doing now is what you would die for, because you could die at any moment. And you know, back to Rilke. You know, I often quote this wonderful poem from Rilke called "The Man Watching," which is about Jacob wrestling with the angel. You know, it's a biblical story. Jacob knew he couldn't win, but he came away strengthened by the fight. And Rilke has this wonderful judgment at the end of the poem. He says, what we fight with is so small. And when we win, it makes us small.
Right.
What we want is to be defeated decisively by successively greater beings. And, you know, I think about some of the great problems of the world. And, you know, I want to see us tackle them. But I want to see us tackle them not with do-goodism. I mean, I'm a big fan of nonprofits. You know, there's quite a few nonprofits that I think are doing incredible work. But in my own career, I have felt like the ability of my company to do good by doing business that has created value for society is huge. And I want to find entrepreneurs who sort of see an opportunity to make the world a better place by filling real needs and shaping a better world. And so that's the first thing, is find stuff that matters.
All right, one more.
Okay,
so that's the first thing. You get a maximum of two.
Okay. Second thing is, you know, find people who are just as passionate about that as you are to work with.
Wonderful. Let's open it up for questions. We have an audience. We have a microphone there and a line forming behind it. Sir, go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Thank you very much. Another Sonoma native here, so nice to see you.
Good. Yeah.
Quick question is, do you have an axiom that you would consider for a startup founder who's trying to make a decision between where to create value for the investors versus where to cleave a line and say, this actually should be something that goes into the ecosystem? How do you make that judgment call?
Well, I think it should be scientific. I remember having this argument with Richard Stallman about open source. I said, you know, the difference between free software and open source is open source should be science, not religion. You know, in other words, it should work. You know, the decision you're making should actually, if you look at it over time, you should believe that it's better for the investor as well as for society. Because, in fact, you know, short-term thinking is not best for a long-term investor. And so, of course, that means you have to find an investor who's also thinking long-term. And, of course, great investors do think long-term. They're not looking for the quick exit. They're looking to build the great company that survives and grows and serves customers over the long term. So, you know, if you're doing it right, you will, in fact, be building a vibrant ecosystem around your company that creates value for a lot of other people, and you'll find that that's actually better for your company. So look for that win-win. Although, as there was a great line from Clay Shirky the other day, you know, Clay is the most quotable person on the planet. He said, these days, win-win seems to mean we win twice for our team.
Hi, Tim. How's it going? My name is Ben Jackson.
Hi, Ben.
Thank you. I noticed that you mentioned Kickstarter and Airbnb. I think you might have mentioned Kickstarter more than once. And I think that one of the interesting things about these companies is not only that they solve real problems, you know, like not tech people problems, but real people problems, but that they manage to unlock some hidden value that, while, you know, like a hotel chain, for example, might spend I don't know how many years creating a national chain of hotels, but they're leveraging existing value that's sort of hidden or buried and digging it up.
Yeah.
You know, Kickstarter as well, with sort of all of these people who are willing to fund things but who aren't, you know, they don't have a few million dollars to fund something. But so I'm curious, where do you see other industries or, you know, these places that are ripe for that kind of disruption? Not the creating and building lots and lots, but the digging it out.
Education?
Yeah.
A huge one. You know, it's sort of interesting. There's a lot of startups in education, I think. That's an area that's going to be very disrupted. Education costs have grown way faster than inflation. There's a lot of ossified institutions. There's new forms of accreditation. You know, if you follow this sort of notion that I have of alpha geeks are often good predictors. I mean, in tech, we don't think about where did somebody go to school so much as what have you done. You know, if you go look at somebody's GitHub profile, that may well be much more important than the fact that they went to, you know, Stanford versus, you know, some other university. You know, there's a new form of accreditation there. So I think there's a lot that's happening in education. Government. Now, with government, with Code for America, we're trying to sort of create, that's a nonprofit, but we're trying to sort of create disruption in government, which is a lot harder. But we're really trying to get civic startups.
But,
we're starting a civic
startup. But you're doing
incubator.
It in partnership with government, which
is the
interesting thing. You're not trying to, like, subvert them.
We're trying to find the innovators in government, give them air cover, make them heroes, make them famous, teach them. You know, and people like Eric Ries of Lean Startup has been working a lot. If you heard, again, you know, Todd Park, I introduced him to Eric a year ago, and he's been running with the whole Lean Startup methodology, going to agencies saying, okay, I want you to propose projects that you can do in 90 days, you know, and then getting a SWAT team of people to help them. And it's awesome, you know, some of the stuff that's happening, you know, and I think that we, you know, one of the things that Jen Palka, the founder of Code for America, who's speaking in the keynote tomorrow you know, sort of focused on is the notion of, you know, how do we actually build crowdsourcing. Her TED talk was, do we want to be just a crowd of voices or are we going to be a crowd of hands? You know, can government, and this is a notion that I've sort of put out that, you know, government needs to start acting like a platform provider rather than a solution provider, you know, create infrastructure that then society can build on. And I think there's a whole other discussion there, which probably could be had in that session.
But education and government are two great places to look for the next wave of tech-flavored disruption.
That's right.
Okay.
Can I ask just one more half question, and you can give me just a yes or a no?
Sorry. One other. Manufacturing. I mean, the whole maker movement just says to me, you know, there's a revolution happening in, you know, in how stuff is going to work in the future.
So my half question is just, do you think that this is mainly limited to enterprise industries, or do you think this is more of a general thing? Not all, but just mainly.
I think it's not just enterprise. No, I mean, I think there's obviously a lot of money in the enterprise, but and certainly there are probably too many. There's too much focus in Silicon Valley on consumer companies, and not enough on sort of enterprise opportunities. You know, versus an earlier era where it was all enterprise.
Hi, my name is Greg. I'm from Inkdit, and this is my third startup. And I'd sold a startup back in the dot-com era, and had, you know, I'd gone to business school, read one of your books on HTML, and started a business and sold it.
Excellent.
And afterwards found myself disillusioned with the whole, you know, creating more value than you capture. I didn't see that in society and in my education in business school. And so my question is, what are the opportunities that you see for us outside of this room, which I'm excited to see people here, but what are the opportunities to get this into the mindset of the business community and into our business schools?
Well, one of the things that I'd love to see is massive shareholder activism. I had an experience that was really eye-opening for me about how corrupt our system is. When I was on the board of Macromedia, I was sent to this thing called Stanford Directors College, which is an executive and director education program. Companies actually get brownie points for this group called Institutional Shareholder Services, which makes recommendations to companies about well-governed, you know, companies. You know, so I thought, oh, great, I'm going to get all this guidance on how to be the director of a public company. And the bulk of the sessions in the program were about how to cover your ass as a director. And I was
how to reduce your chances of getting sued.
That's right.
Okay.
I was ashamed of our society when I took the Stanford Directors College. We need to have a new standard that says, you know, companies need to be held to a higher standard. You know, this is not, you know, I mean, you know, there's a big lie in business, and the big lie in business is, you know, you have only one responsibility, and it's the responsibility to your shareholders to make money. Well, I go, the reason that's a big lie is if that were the case, why the hell are we paying so much to the executives? You know, it's basically, it's this cover story for people who are looting the system. And I think we have a really rotten sort of corporate system. I don't think we know what the solution is yet, but I do think that, you know, I'd love to see a reform that starts with things like executive compensation. I'd love to see, you know, really strong corporate governance. That, you know, I'd love to see us starting to map some of the external, you know, companies being responsible for the externalities. Yep. You know, I mean, like we have so many cases where companies are getting away with enormous profits while creating enormous damages that are basically socialized. And we need to have policymakers who have the guts. You know, periodically in this country, we have somebody comes along and says, you know, we're going to change things. You know, Theodore Roosevelt was like that. Franklin Roosevelt was like that. You know, there are people who come along and say, I'm sorry, you know, rules are about to change here because we've gone off the rails.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, we have gone off the rails and we need some real leadership that is going to start to rethink if we're going to thrive into the future. How do we have to be different? And we need corporate leadership that thinks that same way. How are we going to be different? How are we going to focus on making money while making this world better rather than, well, that's not really our responsibility. Our only responsibility is to make as much money as possible. That's bullshit.
Hi. So you mentioned that a lot of companies start out with a lot of value and then that diminishes. How much is actually a direct result of going public and having absentee owners?
Oh, I think the absentee owner thing is total bullshit. The fact that people have absentee owners allows the people in charge.
The people minding the store.
Yeah, to kind of pretend that they're working on behalf of others while basically working for themselves. As I said, that's why I think we need to see a revolution in corporate governance where you know, shareholders. You know, again, you know, you got to think about the way the financial markets. Nobody really owns companies anymore. You know, a few people do. Warren Buffett. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett, you know, kind of buys and holds a company because he believes in it. You know, whereas like if you're doing algorithmic trading, it's just betting. You know.
Hi, my name is Jeff Hoffer, and I've been out of work since 2009, and I am looking at the economy in a way that the old economic rules that everything's based on a scarcity of resources we need for survival doesn't seem to fit the economy that we have now, but we're still playing by those old rules. The current scarcity seems to be in jobs, and whatever you think about manufacturing, those are eventually all going to go away as robotics get better. How do we
Well, they're not necessarily all going to go away. I do think that we have to really start thinking about, you know, how does manufacturing change and where is the value added? And that's why I mentioned, you know, this lamp bought on Etsy, you know, as sort of human value added. And because there's a real analogy between that lamp bought on Etsy and the YouTube video that somebody created for someone else. There are ways that, in which that human creative touch is going to be more and more valued. Like if we went to this, you know, this is, if we went to this world where everything was made by machines, and this, by the way, is depicted beautifully in Cory Doctorow's first novel, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. It's a world where of nanotechnology driving abundance, and there's a new economy that's based on reputation, and people are basically earning what he calls woofy points, you know, and the woofy points are what you spend, you know. And, you know, this is sort of way, way from where we are today. But you can start to see, because there are ways that you can start, you know, we do live in a woofy economy, and some of these new things.
But you can't
things,
take that woofy and buy a loaf of bread.
But we are figuring out how to exchange woofy for money. You know, like, so Kickstarter is exchanging woofy for money. You know, advertising, you know, shares on, you know, YouTube or, you know, for a viral video, that's converting woofy to money. So this is, in fact, starting to happen, and I think it will happen in the physical world as well, making things, you know, you take the commodity layer, and then you figure out how to add value to it.
So to our questioner's point, manufacturing is actually a huge and growing industry in the U.S. every year, while employing fewer people in the U.S. every year. You think that might be headed for a change in direction?
It's possible. I don't know. You know, I mean, again, I think there's... It's very hard to predict the future based on early signs. But, you know, I think as we distribute the tools of manufacturing, we're going to find new and creative businesses that are niches.
Great.
You know, so there's a great example. This guy, John Hart, goes by @FarmGeek, is this former programmer who became an organic farmer, and he's now kind of a maker, and he's... Yeah, you know, he's already developed two little mini business the things that are mini business ideas out of his work at organic farming. One was he's manufacturing on his 3D printer copies of this invasive butterfly that lays its eggs on a plant, but they're territorial, so if they see other butterflies there, they don't lay their eggs. So he's kind of making these little butterflies on his 3D printer, and the other is a Arduino-based sensor for keeping, you know, tracking the temperature of meat as it moves through the supply chain. You know, people are figuring out how to make stuff again, you know, for specialized niches.
Got it.
Anyway, sorry, I'm talking too long in response to these questions.
Good. So I've heard this sort of notion of collective advantage versus competitive advantage. And I think the optimist in me loves this idea of collective advantage, right, that we build value through a collective advantage as a great business value. But the pragmatist in me thinks that in the business world, the reality is the biggest predator wins. So in positioning to the Fortune 100, Global 1000, these big companies, in your opinion, what's the likelihood that this idea of collective advantage is a real thing that can be marketed against in terms of business value that they can compete against? And if you think that's true, if you have any ideas of businesses as a case study?
I guess what I would just sort of say, I mean, now obviously O'Reilly's in a small niche, but we've operated by these set of principles, and we became the largest independent publisher of computer books. And, you know, there's a couple of conglomerates that are sort of through all their collective things that they bought are a little bigger. That's sort of a small example. We're, you know, a pretty big fish in a small pond. But, you know, you look at Google, particularly in its early, really values-driven phase. You know, now they're kind of not so sure about that. And I wish they would kind of stick to their original vision. You know, they really took on this whole industry, you know, with a pretty singular focus on, you know, creating value for their customers as opposed to, you know, trying to chase the dollars. And, you know, I think that as Google, you know, is increasingly dominated by commercial concerns, you're going to watch them get less successful. You know, and I think this is true of so many companies. You know, you follow that idealistic arc, you know, and it actually works. And it's, you know.
But your further point is that when it doesn't work, it's going to get disrupted by somebody who does do a better job.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to your question, what we can look forward to if these large enterprises lose their way is getting disrupted from down below.
Yeah.
Okay. I see our countdown timer has expired. We have time for one more question. I'm going to take the silence as a yes.
All right.
Last one. Oh, you're not a questioner.
Then we just...
You're the end of the line. So we have reached the end of the line. I just want to say thank you all for attending. And of course, Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you very much, Andy, for doing this. Thank you.